Welcome to Umbrella Rebellion. I'm Marcy.
And I'm Dee.
We are finding healing after leaving a cult.
We will be discussing abuse and personal experience with the ATI, IBLP, and fundamental churches.
Trigger warning. This podcast may contain descriptions of various forms of abuse. Please take care for your safety and well-being while you are listening.
If the content becomes too much for you to handle, please turn this off. We hope to expose harmful teachings that lead to and justify abuse,
with the hope that those that are experiencing abuse can find support and escape from it.
Okay. All right. Now I forgot how to do this thing again, and we just did this earlier today. Oh, yeah. Welcome to Umbrella Rebellion. Hey, Marcy.
Hi, Dee.
Hey, everybody. Today, we are going to be talking about therapy. Season two has been all about the different types of abuse so far. We've talked about what to look for, what could be signs of it, but we are not professionals. And so we wanted today to bring a professional on to talk about mental health that can talk about it from a professional standpoint with a lot more knowledge than we do. So we would like to introduce you to the therapist that we have, who is also a podcast host as well. She is part of the dynamic duo from Never Thought I'd Say This with Jody Sweeten. Please welcome the Celia Behar.
Over here and add this.
And then, hey, Celia.
Hi. I love that I'm getting introduced as the Celia Behar now because of my handle. Like, thank you for that.
I love it.
It's, you know, everyone's like, oh, that's so ego-based. It's not, believe it or not, there's another Celia Behar. That is why I had to ask the, you know, put in the C, which is just like, what in the world? Like, I have the most uncommon name. I never meet anyone with the name Celia. And of course, like, there's somebody that is named Celia. Like, why? And the last name. Weird.
Yeah,
right?
That's really weird.
So strange.
Yeah. I know. So I was like, it's not me being like an egomaniac. I swear to God. It's just that it existed someplace else, so I had to put the in it because it was better, you know, with my personality and my stupid sense of humor. I would have put, like, you know, 69 at the end or something stupid.
Yes. I mean, you know, keep it professional, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Or 69. I mean, you can't have it both ways.
I know. I mean, it's so funny you just said that because my daughter was in here before and I said something about, oh, are you going to wear something professional? And I go, I don't dress professional. And she goes, oh, no, you're not professional, mom. And I was like,
thank you, daughter.
She knows right. You well. She knows you well.
I know. I was like, I am too. I said, you just don't dress like, I'm not wearing like a button up shirt or something. That's not who I am. And she was like, okay.
Well, I mean, you fit the motif. We're, you know, I mean, we're all moms. Come on. Like, Why would we put the effort in if we don't have to?
Well, here's my thing. When I went to grad school to become a therapist, I talked to one of my teachers once because, you know, when you go to school, you have to do obviously like a lot of training and you have to, part of when you become a therapist is that you get clients and then you record yourself, like you get their permission, you record yourself. And then you have to transpose the entire session, like, and after every single line, you put what you were doing what you think they might be doing. Yeah, it's pretty intense. And it takes hours.
Yeah.
And I remember the first time I did it and I had dropped the F-bomb in my session. And yeah. And then I did the thing. And I said to my teacher, like, I was like, I'm sorry, I dropped the F-bomb in there. Like, that was really not okay. And she went, why? That's how you talk. And because I always talk like that in class. And I said, yeah, but I feel like that's not professional. And she said, well, you got to know your audience. Obviously, that was what she related to. And so it doesn't matter, you know. And she's like, and quite frankly, like, that's the thing about becoming a therapist. And we'll talk about this anyway, because this is kind of the topic, is that you want to be able to be the right therapist for the right client. And I'm not going to be for everybody.
Right.
Not because nobody is. Yeah. And so she was like, I don't think you should change anything about your personality. Like, if people are really offended by cursing, chances are you guys aren't going to mesh anyway. So probably not the right client for you. You refer them to somebody else. And that's happened.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good thing. I mean, we're all about being authentic because we spent so many years being forced to be something we're not. And so Like, I was like, she is our kind of people because she answered a random Instagram message. Like, yeah, sure, I'll come on your podcast.
Well, why not? I mean, first of all, the, like I said, you know, topic is fascinating to me in general as somebody who, you know, has studied that. And I'm always like, I'm the girl that watches all the documentaries about, you know, cults and different things, because I think people think it's so out of the realm of what could happen to them. But quite frankly, you catch anybody at any age or stage of their life, depending on how vulnerable they are. Yeah. And, you know, and how things are presented to them. And if it feels like an answer and you feel like you're accepted, I think anyone is susceptible to things like that. And so it fascinates me, but also it's trauma coming out, and PTSD and trauma-based therapy is something really near and dear to my heart and something that I've been studying for a long time and I continue to study. And I've been pretty open about the fact that I've experienced physical trauma and emotional trauma. So, you know, I think that's really important. It's part of why I became a therapist. I was an abused child and I really wanted to understand, you know, what happened to me and be able to help others that were abused. So, and it's abuse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a lot of the similar things that are our goals here is, number one, exposing the cult for what it is, and that it's not just weak-minded people that can get involved in this. And it could be you on a bad day that gets sucked into something. And then for the survivors of it is, it wasn't because of you that you got sucked into this. A lot of them grew up in it.
Yeah.
I was an outlier that, you know, as a young adult, you know, joined it. But it's like, you just meet the right person on the right day. And if they're a cult leader, then you're like, you can be, you know, anybody can be susceptible to it. And I think raising awareness for what to look for is so important, because it's like they're coming out of the weeds. I know they've always been there, but with the internet, it's so much easier to pinpoint them now because people can share their stories like we do online.
Well, and I think there's a misconception about what qualifies as a cult, because there isn't really a definition anyway. But I think people think back to like Jamestown and, you know, the Mansons, and that's like the only thing they have to go on. And that's not true. You know, I mean, even like looking back at what happened in Oregon, you know, what was that, the 90s, 80s or 90s with, forget her name, but, you know, when the food got poisoned, you know, and all that stuff happened in Portland and I think in Eugene as well, you know, it was presented as more of like a community. You know, people thought they were like in sort of like a commune, and there's yoga and there's a guru, and like, you know, you could see it felt, you know, the way it was presented felt very like Dalai Lama-ish, even though it was not at all. And people feel like they're connecting with a higher power, which is a beautiful thing to have a higher power, but they're actually being taken advantage of and, you know, controlled and manipulated and changed, and they don't know that. Yeah. You know, it's too late most of the time. And then thankfully, a lot of people get out.
Yeah, that we talked about that. It's the slow burn, or like the frog in the pot. The temperature gradually rises. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, oh, shit, how did I get here?
Yeah. Yeah. But listen, I think that's not unlike, and I know that a lot of the, my hair's caught in my earring.
Of course.
I know a lot of the studies that have been done about people who leave cults, they find a lot of similarities, and there haven't been a lot of studies. There should be more, but they have found a lot of similarities between people who've left cults or gotten out of cults and battered partners, you know, battered women and men. And PTSD is a huge thing for anyone who has been able to get out of a cult. And the things that people experience, depression and PTSD and OCD and re-entry into society and learning how to trust again, that is, you know, very, very connected to, or very much the same as being in a domestic abuse situation. And I know that like lots of group therapy that happens when it's geared at people who have gotten out of cults, a lot of times there are people who also are in those group therapies for domestic who've been, you know, part of a DB situation.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's almost like you can't have one without the other.
Yeah.
I mean,
hand in hand.
It's so intertwined into the different types of abuse that it's like, if you have one, it's just, it's a matter of time before the rest happens.
Yeah, most likely. I know there's a pretty big correlation between the two of them. And, it's like I said, trauma is trauma.
Yeah.
And, there's certainly different ways to treat it. And there's different therapists that are trained to do different things. And I know that's what we wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
So I did have one question for you, because, we had talked about just a minute ago that there really isn't a good definition of a cult. So I wanted to kind of get your opinion, or what you see as, I guess, a guideline more of what you would consider a cult.
Well, I mean, I think when you're brought into a situation where it feels like an enclave, situation, you're usually slowly manipulated away out from your friends and your family and isolated and brought into a different, I'm going to use community for lack of a better word. Mm-hmm. And then that manipulation, destroys your outside connections and starts to change who you are. A lot of what I've read about treating people who have gotten out of cults is that usually you have to act like you're treating two people. You're treating the person that they became while they were in the cult and who they were before they got in there. So I would define it personally as any sort of, and again, this is just me personally, any sort of, enclave situation where people are systematically brought into a situation where things are changing about their personalities and they're starting to be isolated. And I know a lot of the time that also means that money is taken from them and other, things are taken from them. And often there's sexual abuse and certainly always emotional abuse, even if they don't realize there's emotional abuse.
Right. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Cause sometimes it's really hard to narrow it down to, a definition, right? There's so many different types of things that could be considered a cult, but I think that's a very good point. Is a lot of it has to do with the isolation and destroying your relationships that you had before you met this community, right?
Right. I mean, and I know people like to joke, about certain political groups, being cultish. I've certainly made the same joke, but the fact is that's not a cult. Those are decisions, and not that you can't get sucked into that. I would certainly qualify QAnon as a cult.
Mm-hmm. Like, oh yeah.
They are isolated. They are, manipulated, and there is money taken and stuff like that. So I'm sure I'll get hate mail for that. If anyone.
Bring it on.
Honestly, what else is new? It's fine. But I think it's a lot. And I think there's been also more cults that don't qualify. Like, people wouldn't think of them as cults almost, because again, that word is just so broad. But even what's happened to, non-binary, transgender, not single out necessarily any one religion, but certain religions pull people who, have different identities, who identify, in a different way.
Yeah.
And what that religion qualifies them as or classifies them as, they come and they want to change who they are. They take them. I mean, and their families usually are like, yes, please take them. I don't think that's any different. They're still trying to isolate you from your family and change who you are and make you into something that, authentically you are not.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
we've talked before about how we felt like we had to find ourselves after we came out of the cult. Like, we literally had to rebuild who we were, because we were what they wanted, not who we really were. So that tracks with our experience there.
Yeah. I had to fight the whole time I was in it of what I was before and then what I tried to be. And I'm like, this, I cannot do this. I cannot be a submissive wife. I'm sorry. It's just not in me.
And I even had an experience of, I grew up in it. So since I was five, so I didn't know anything different. So I came out of it. I started finding myself, then got myself into an abusive marital relationship, lost myself again, and then had to rebuild again after I came out of that. Mm-hmm. So I even had two parts where I was rebuilding and then lost it and then rebuilt again. So that makes sense.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. I think, and often that's the case with people who get into DV relationships. They've experienced some sort of abuse before and it feels familiar.
It really did.
Mm-hmm. That, you pick the same partner kind of over and over again until you realize that you know, maybe it's you, so to speak, in the sense that you're seeking out people that feel, and you're like, you think it's this great love connection, but really it's that you're repeating a pattern. You're like, oh, it feels so familiar. They feel like home. And it's like, yes, but what is home like?
Right. Exactly. Home wasn't necessarily safe or comfortable. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of the problem, you know, and until you recognize that, but you do need a good therapist, I think, to help you get out of that. It's hard. And there's a lot of, yeah, I think with domestic violence and with, you know, trauma from leaving cults, like, I think there's a lot of shame and embarrassment that you can't believe you were that person because you probably looked at those people and been like, how does that happen? You know, although if you're raised in it, I'm sure it's a little different, but then you can get
It was exactly like that. I mean, I was in the abused wife position, and I was saying, "What? How do wonderful women get stuck with these terrible, terrible men?" I was saying that while it was happening to me. So yes, it's all twisted into there, and then shame when I got out of it and realized that's what I was saying. And I'm like, how did I not?
No, and you know, it's like women that are or men too. I don't even want to say women or men.
Right.
Everyone across all humans who get out of you know, abusive relationships. I think it's so interesting because never in my life has someone who's gotten out of an abusive relationship and talked to me about it have I been like, ooh, you know, that's like, you're really an idiot. You know, I'm like, you're so strong and so amazing. And I'm so sorry that happened to you, but like, look, you're out and you have a new, you're like, you know, I'm just so proud of whoever that is. Mm-hmm. But when you're in it, it's like, you can't see that. You feel like, oh my God, they must be judging me. And what, you know, how did I end up here? How am I this person?
Yes. And that is why having a therapist is a really good idea. Because as I was coming out, she was able to tell me those things. And so, yeah, our exact reason.
Well, I think that's the thing, is to find a therapist who gets it.
Yes. And those are hard to find. So
going into the reason we have you here, great segue. So what kind of tips would you have people who are coming out of the cult or a religious, spiritual, abusive situation? What do you think is most important to ask their therapist so they can find a good fit that, and somebody who is going to, number one, hopefully have the knowledge and training to deal with this kind of thing?
Yeah. And there's not really a like specialized, at least to the best of my knowledge, I don't know that there's a specialized like certification in, you know, anyone who's leaving a cult, but certainly people who have experience in trauma-based therapy, you know, EMDR has done wonders. There is a book called The Body Keeps the Score that I think is like, should be necessary reading for anyone who's experienced trauma. So they understand like where it is in their body. But I think that when you're getting out of a cult situation or any sort of situation where you've been emotionally abused and mind controlled to a certain extent, you want to find a therapist that, you know, again, has some knowledge of trauma-based therapy and, or, you know, if they're going to use any kind of self-disclosure that they've gone through stuff like that, because then you're going to find a connection. And self-disclosure, I always find personally in my practice, is one of the things that connects me the most to my clients, because I think it's hard to sit with, you know, a therapist where you're like, I don't know anything about this person. And they're saying is, oh, and how does that make you feel? And how does that make you feel? You know, and you're thinking in your head, like, well, I feel like shit, that's why I'm here.
Yeah. You can swear.
Like, you know, you're like, that's why I'm here. Like, what the heck? Like, and you think to yourself, like, why do I want to open up to this person? I have no idea if they have any understanding of anything I'm going through. Or if they can do it all. And again, that's something I learned in grad school, is, you know, you use self-disclosure to a certain extent if you're comfortable with it, if you feel like that's a way to connect.
Yeah.
And I'll do that because I'm kind of an open book anyway about things, so I don't really care.
Yeah, that's why I think you're a good fit for us, because we have no filter either. And I mean, I listen to y'all's podcast a lot and I'm like, oh my God, these are my people.
I mean, I'm a therapist who just was like, you know, in a YouTube still in my pasties, like with Jody staring at my boobs. So that, I'm like, if that doesn't get me some new clients, like.
Might get you the wrong clients, but it might get
you. I know. I'll probably get therapists reaching out to me being like, do you need another therapist? What was that? my daughter's cat, George Michael, has joined us.
Oh my God, I love the cat's name.
George Michael and Maybe. They're named after Arrested Development.
I love it.
George Michael is loud and he only has three legs and no tail. So he's going to apparently keep me company.
Oh, he's the three-legged cat. I love it.
He is the three-legged cat. If he comes close enough, I'll pick him up. So, you know, I think, first of all, people need to know, like, that what you're looking for in a therapist should be, like, you want to find a way to break out of the magical thinking that's usually been programmed into you as far as cult stuff goes. Mm-hmm. And you want a therapist who can help you with critical thinking.
Yes.
That's the change, right? Because mm-hmm. you're like, you've been fed this like magical woo-woo stuff and we're all in a bubble. And, you know, I'm not that it's all woo-woo, but you know what I mean? And yeah. again, even if it's DV, you've been fed a certain line of gaslighting or whatever. And so you don't even trust your own judgment anymore. Yep. Yes, so you want a therapist that can help you with critical thinking to help you reacclimate into society. And again, like I said, you know, they want to counsel you who you were in the cult or in the DV, but they also need to find who you were before that and see if they can merge the two to get you back into society. So, and to act like, they're, you know, oh, I'm just going to bring you back from where who you were and kind of skip over what you've gone through. I think that's a problem. So if you're searching for a good therapist and they seem to be like just trying to like snap you out of it, that's probably an issue and likely not a good match.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What I always say to my clients about therapy in general, like the first time I ever talk to anyone who wants to work with me, I'm like, listen, you don't have to worry about me. This is a job and it needs to be a relationship and something that you trust. And so you are not going to hurt my feelings if at the end of this session, you never want to talk to me again. There's no pressure here. You're not responsible for me in any way whatsoever. You need to feel comfortable. I will be fine. I can only help you if you can trust me and we are a match. If you don't feel that, then we got nowhere to go. Yeah. And even if it means that I don't have, you know, there, God, I mean, COVID, you know, COVID and school shootings and all the stuff that's happened. It's like, I've had to say to my clients so many times, you know, I've never been through this either. So mm-hmm. we're going to have to learn what this is doing to everybody and to you as we go. Right. And I will continue to find new resources, but this is new for me too. I obviously have no experience, you know, counseling in a pandemic. I mean, I do now, but I didn't.
Yeah, not at the beginning.
Right. Nobody had since, you know, like the Spanish flu. So, you know,
exactly.
We were in territory, you know?
Exactly. And I think that's the biggest piece of finding a therapist. Like, regardless, I think, of what you've gone through or your reasons for it, it has to be a match. It is a job. Mm-hmm. So it has to be a match. What I would say to people that are coming out of DV stuff and you know, and coming out of a cult though, is to, because I think you don't trust your own judgment a lot of the time.
Yeah.
You know, watch projections. Like we all have a tendency to project onto people. And it might be like, if that therapist reminds you of somebody in the cult or that's probably not right for you. Because you need to make a distinction between people. And that's nothing against the therapist.
Right.
But if you're projecting onto them, that might be an issue unless they spot it real fast.
Yes.
And, you know, like Oprah says, because I quote Oprah all the time, doubt means no. If there's something in the pit of your stomach when you're talking to a therapist and you're like, I don't know, then it's no. You don't even need a reason. It's just not a match.
That is a good point, because in the cult and in our religious spiritual upbringing, doubting things was something that they told us to ignore, you know?
Yeah. Right.
That could be the Holy Spirit putting, you know, conviction on you to change something that you're doing, you know, or it could be Satan, you know, trying to tempt you away from God, right?
Right. So society getting involved in what they don't understand, or your family members are trying to control you and, you know, they don't understand the higher purpose of your, you know, yeah.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, we were trained out of critical thinking and trusting our gut, you know, and that is definitely something that I agree. Like, that's important for your therapist to, you know, help you realize, and also you have permission to be like, no, this isn't working if it doesn't feel good. And you need to give yourself permission to be like, this feels too culty.
Yeah. And on the first visit, I've gone through multiple ones. I had to interview multiple ones before I found the one that I liked and that really helped. But I went to one, two or three different times because I thought, oh, it'll get better next time. Oh, it'll get better. You know, this gut stuff will leave. And maybe it's just, I'm uncomfortable with the subject matter, not the counselor. And then I was like, nope, can't do it. But I should have done that on the first, you know, try instead of the third. So if you've got done like the first time, don't go
back. I guess more of a chance, but you know, and I've done that because I want to believe that, you know, I'm in therapy. I go to therapy. I think everyone should be in therapy, but
agreed.
Honestly, like who doesn't want to talk about their crap for an hour, you know, like and get it out. It seems like the best thing to do, but I've had to leave therapists for feeling like they weren't listening to me, noticing that in a session, they were like falling asleep. That's happened to me. I had one that I really like the first session. I really liked her. It was when my sister was sick and I knew at that point she was going to die. And then she missed two sessions with me after that. And I was like, I mean, that was it. And I never called her back. Like, and then she's like, oh, I'm thinking about you and your sister. Like, call me, let's reschedule. And I was like, no, like I'm already experiencing abandonment and loss. I needed this as an anchor. And
yeah.
That was the end of that. And it happens, you know, yeah. I've had, cause I do more virtual and a lot of people that I work with are more comfortable being on the phone so that I'm not looking at them when they cry, which I totally understand because I am the same way. And I cry through so many of my therapy sessions and we're on the phone and I'm like, yay, she can't see me. Fantastic.
Yes.
Like who wants to see me ugly cry with like snot down my face? Not me, you know? And it's like, not even that she can see. It's like, certainly when it's like this too, you're like, oh, yeah. You see me, but I can see me. So like, really know.
Right. Like, I know what I look like now when I ugly cry. I don't need that.
Yeah. Like that's not helping anything. I'll tell you right now. But I've had clients say to me, you know, call me out, which I'm happy they have. And they're like, I didn't feel like you were listening to me. Mm-hmm. Like, you seemed like you were busy or doing something else. And, you know, and often when that's happened, either that's not true at all. And the connection was weird. Or I'm like, I'm taking notes. And I forget sometimes to tell people that I'm taking notes.
And
I'm like, I'm so sorry. I was actually taking notes. I'm totally listening to you. But I, you know, especially when someone's sort of on a long thing where they're telling me a bunch of things and I don't want to interrupt them.
Right.
But I want to like write down real quick, like points so I can track back, you know, but I'm like, wow, like, thank God that, you know, those clients will say that to me and they feel comfortable because if they didn't, how would I know? And I don't want them to feel like that.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Yep.
You need your clients to feel comfortable also like saying that to you. Right. And you need a therapist. And I think that people go back and forth. I mean, sometimes we need therapists that are of the opposite sex to work out stuff, you know, in that way. And sometimes you need the same sex. And often we need someone that, you know, I think most importantly, you mesh with and that you feel is completely non-judgmental.
Yes.
And that you can say anything to, and they're not going to judge you or they won't seem shocked or, you know, anything like that. My kids are always like, make comments about how I can be so monotone. And I'm like, well, it's kind of my job. You know?
I have to do this.
You know, it's like, could you imagine if everything they told me, I was like, oh my God, you know, like,
Hey, do you need me to have a shocked reaction? Is that what you're looking for? Like,
right.
Preempt this with, I want you to be shocked and then I will.
Right. Exactly.
What's the reaction you're looking for?
Right. I mean, listen, sometimes I am, you know, and that's reading your client too. Like I know when my clients are hoping that I'm going, you know, sometimes I have like a client that starts a session with, are you sitting down? You better be sitting down. Yes. Listen, and the fuck if I'm not going to sit down, because I'm like, okay, you know,
I'm ready. Hit me.
What do you got to tell me? Like, it's going to be big. But I think, you know, it's just something you want to be able to disclose as much as you possibly can. Mm-hmm. And certainly in situations when you're leaving a cult, and again, domestic violence as well, you need someone who has a ton of patience. Yeah. Like, you have to find someone who's patient because there's going to be backsliding. There's going to be you know, discomfort, there's going to be so much self-doubt, because that's what's been ingrained, is the self-doubt to keep you controlled. And I think a lot of the time that does get projected onto a counselor. Mm-hmm. And you need a counselor that's prepared for that and understands right. that they have to be patient and be steady and calm and walk, you know, walk side by side.
And reassure, yeah. you know, and help you realize that the doubting is, you know, is counterproductive to healing, you know, and it's like, you've got to help you trust yourself, you know, mm-hmm. learn to trust yourself. And a good, and I feel like in my experience, a good counselor is going to help you learn how to trust those gut feelings.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, it's also, it's part of it. Like you mm-hmm. can't walk around it. The only way to get through it is to walk actually through it. You cannot walk around it. So even the self-doubt and like not knowing where you stand and not trusting yourself, that's not something that a counselor should be like, well, just trust yourself and walk on. You know,
you
gotta go into the reasons. You gotta face mm-hmm. it head on and sit with those feelings, because that's the only way to get through it.
Yeah. My counselor was slow. I was so slow to come to that point. And my counselor paced well with me, saying, okay, well, you're not quite ready for that, but let's just go slowly into it so that I would walk through it, even if it was slowly.
Right. But that's, and I think that's what I mean about being patient, you know, like,
yeah,
she was something that, I mean, not that there's a quick fix for really anything.
No, but
no, just boo-boos when you're a toddler.
Yeah.
Yes. And even that, you know, can get infected and picked at and, you know, like,
yeah. Well, way to just turn my, you know, positivity right into a shit show. Thanks, Celia. Well, yeah. I can get infected. And
I'm very good at that. You know, I also, I will say that in some of the stuff that I've read, well, first of all, I also know that forensic psychologists mm-hmm. have more training in cult behavior okay. and think people coming out of cults, because they profile cults in general. So they also mm-hmm. usually work with people who are leaving. I know it's very hard to find a forensic psychologist. They're very few and far between. Some social workers also specialize in that. From everything I've read, and I think, you know, and even what I've been trained in, I think that the key in so many ways is to be in group therapy at the same time as being in individual therapy. My cat is hitting the
I had not heard that. That's really cool.
Me either. Yeah.
Yeah. I've read a bunch of articles about that and about how, for two different reasons. And also there is a support and like a aftercare sort of, you know, field that emerged, and it's support and recovery of ex-members. And a lot of the time you can go to different places. Like there's a organization called Refocus.
Oh, okay.
Which I've read about a few times. It's a cult aftercare nonprofit that connects ex-members with specialists and support groups in every state, Canada, and the UK.
Oh, that is awesome. Nice. They have a website?
They do. I think it's just refocus.com, but if you just Google refocus, and it's us, you know, small R, E, and then capital F, focus. Okay. And I think that that's a really cool thing, that because like it is such a specialized niche to like work with people who have left cults. And then a lot of the research that I've read over the years has talked about either being in group therapy with other ex-members who have been able to leave. And a lot of the time, those groups will be co-run. The therapist is the leader, but the co-leader is usually somebody who is also an ex-member. Oh. So that you get both who's in recovery and who has reemerged back into society. And I know the lot that those exist all over the place. And then the other thing that I have read over and over again, actually, I watched a documentary about, I can't remember which it was. I feel like it was the one here. Anyway, that the when they were getting members out, and listen, that's a whole other topic, right? Like the like pull them out, you know, and I mean, that's like a whole other thing that, you know, we could spend 5 hours on, because there's so much controversy over whether or not that works. And it has to, you know, I mean, and I'm not sure. I just don't know. I don't know that there's enough research to know, but I do know where people have left cults and they are in group counseling and they're in individual therapy. And the group counseling is for lots of people, but it teaches them how to reacclimate in a group in a trusting manner where they're learning right boundaries. And learning to trust their gut and learning how to be social again outside of a cult setting, because so much of what happens when you leave a cult is that, you know, again, you don't know what to do. Lots of people become agoraphobic. They don't want to leave their house. They don't know how to function back in society because you don't trust anyone and you don't trust yourself. And so doing both of those things side by side, there's been a lot of really good outcomes in the research that's been shown, which makes sense to me.
Yeah, that does make sense.
And I would say along with that is a lot of people, especially in the fundamental Christian cults or followings, is we lose our community. Mm-hmm. So we have no one to support mm-hmm. us through it. I can't speak from personal experience because I've never lost my whole entire community, but I lost a good portion of it in different ways. I've always had my family unit, which I'm so thankful for, because some people don't even have that. Mm-hmm. And if you're in group therapy, I was just like, wow, I don't know why I didn't even think about that, because that's a way for you to find like-minded people who are going through the same thing you are going through to kind of hopefully replace in a healthy way the community you lost.
Well, and I think that's why the foundation of 12-step programs works the mm-hmm. same in that same way, right? Like you're replacing alcohol or sex or love addiction or drugs, you know, with a like-minded fellowship where you are seeing that you're not alone. And that's why, and you have outreach and, you know, you've got sponsorship and the same sort of stuff so that you are also reacclimating into society and leaving that old self behind. And I know a lot of the time, you know, 12-step gets that a bad rap of like, you know, oh, it's really culty, which, listen, before I knew a lot about 12-step, before I went into, you know, and learned about rehab counseling, I certainly felt the same way. And I absolutely was so wrong. And I'm so glad that I know so much more, because, and I always found that because I'm just of religion, because I was raised really religiously. And so I shy away from it. But, you know, one of the steps is you surrender your will to God as you define God.
Yeah.
And it's that line, you know, that people I think don't always hear. You know, it's about, again, it's like finding your own higher power. Nothing wrong with that. That is how people get sucked in a lot of the time to things. If you can replace, you know, that with a healthy thing, like, you know, group therapy, exactly. Like you get a fellowship and you get a community back.
Yeah. I spent a lot of time in Al-Anon through my first marriage, and it saved me. Mm-hmm. It really did, because I literally thought I was going insane, you know, because of the gaslighting. And I really believe my ex was living an alternate reality. And I was like, this doesn't seem like real life. And I call my sister and I'm like, is this right? Is this weird? Because I feel like this is weird. And she's like, yes, that's weird. And I'm like, okay, my gut was right.
You know? I used family that way too. Siblings specifically, sisters. Mm-hmm. They kept me because I couldn't get out enough to be able to get to a group. They were the ones that did that for me until I was able to get out and get to more. But I didn't ever go to a group thing. I think that sounds really neat. What a good idea.
I mean, I don't think I think you could go now. You know, I would go like do one now, especially if you've never done group therapy, by the way. Group therapy is fantastic. I mean, we had to do that's when you're in school to be, I mean, depending on your program, but when you're in school to become a therapist, you know, you have to be in therapy. And B, you know, you get trained in group therapy, but the way that they train you is that your class becomes the group therapy.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yes. It's pretty intense and amazing. And like, you know, it was probably one of my favorite experiences in grad school. And I know what you said is like so dead on when you're like, is this normal? Is this right? I don't even know anymore.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You talk yourself out of it. You're like, no, because this person would never, you know, do this. And you know, and I agree with you. Like I say to people all the time, your siblings are your best historians. Mm-hmm. Because only they know mm-hmm. what you went through, because they were there, assuming they were there. I will say this, because I it's a revelation I had when I was in therapy, and I find that people coming out so I will also tell you, I've never worked with anyone that's come out of a cult. My mainstay though with my clients are people coming out of domestic violence situation. Mm-hmm. That is more my clientele than anything. Mm-hmm. And usually I am their therapist as they're leaving. And then stay with them after. I more than anyone, I mean, I have a lot of specialty with working with teens because I work with at-risk kids for a very long time. And then my other mainstay is that. And I'm not totally sure how it happened other than I think because I've been so open about being an abused child and I left an abusive marriage that people have come to me. So I know exactly the stages that they're going to go through. I also know that it takes, you know, anywhere between 7 to 10 times to get someone out of a situation like that. I have, I have someone going through it right now, a friend of mine, not a client. And, you know, my ex-boyfriend used to get so frustrated with her and be like, I just don't understand why she can't leave and get mad. And I would look at him and say, like, I didn't, you know, like, she's not doing it on her own. Right. And I think that's the same with, you know, with cults and everything I've read has said the same thing where, you know, and that's why that whole like removing somebody against their will, it rarely works.
Yeah.
And if it does, there's still a lot of other trauma to process. It has to, you have to want it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You have to be ready to walk away.
Yep. Absolutely. It's just like people who deal with addiction. If they're not ready to be healthy, then it's not going to work to remove the crutch and, you know, and you have to be able to see it for what it is. And if you can't see it for what it is, you don't think there's anything unsafe about where you are. So you're just going to go right back to it when you can.
Another thing I've talked to family members, because family, when people hear about my DV experience and kind of what I went through and stuff, it's usually families, friends, somebody that's trying to help somebody else get out. Like they see what's happening. They want them to get out, but they're not ready yet. And they'll come to me and say, how can I help them? And I'll say, well, first off, they have to be ready, but then just stay available. Because if my family and my friends had not stayed available over and over and over and over again, you know, I would have gotten out at 7 tries instead of just 4. It only took me 4, but it would have taken more had they not stayed available. So
you're looking for that in a therapist, by the way, as well. You want to find a therapist who's going to stay available that, you know, even if you're slipping back or, you know, have you're hitting bottom lines, and we all have bottom lines. We all have top line behaviors. And when you leave a, you know, a DV relationship, when you leave a cult, there are going to be behaviors that you slip back into all the time, because that's what, you know, it feels familiar. It feels comforting, even though it's actually harming you. Mm-hmm. And you said something earlier that, now I can't remember which one of you said it, but saying the word abuse is so, it's so hard to say. And I remember it with my therapist before I became one, I was like, I said to him, I used to say it all the time. I'm like, well, I was somewhat abused as a kid. And he at one time, and now, and I have clients say that to me all the time now. So I'm always like, hold on. So he finally said to me one day, you keep saying somewhat, can you give me an example? Like what you think was abuse? Because I wasn't sure, you know, with my mom, I was like, but she was my mom and it was discipline. And this is, you know, the thing. And I told him one of the things that she would do. And he just said, okay, so that's not somewhat abused. That's abuse.
Yes. Yes. And
once he said it, I was like, oh, whoa.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still in my marriage. It still took, I have to lower my voice because my kids, I mean, not that they don't know, but my marriage, it took until our couples counselor said to me in front of him, I need you to have an emergency plan. I need you to pack a to-go bag.
In front of him? Wow. She told you in front of him?
Yep.
She said
to him, and she's like, this is where we're at. And if you do touch her one, and he never hit me, which is another thing. I think people mistake. They're like, did he hit you? If he didn't hit you, it's not abuse. It's like,
exactly. Yeah. That's what I got a lot.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a mark on me until the very last one. So it didn't count as abuse.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and mental, let's talk. I mean, mental abuse. And I've listened to your show about it. I mean, it's, you know, that's, please, everyone needs to get on board. This is, you know, that gaslighting is abuse and mental abuse. And that, again, that comes back to being in a cult as well. Like that's what's being done to you. And I hear a lot of people when we talk about cults are like, well, you know, they weren't sexually abused, so they could have left. Like it wasn't, you know, it's like, no, that's not how.
Yes.
That's not how that works.
That's not how that works. But, you know, she said it, she's like, she said to him that, and she, you know, to me, and she said, you know, you, anything else happens and I will hotline the kids. And I left that day. And I just remember I drove home separately. I remember sitting in my car as I was driving, going like thinking to myself, how in the hell did I get here?
Mm-hmm.
Who am I that I am a therapist. Right. And the therapist just said to me, you need to have an emergency plan. I need to see it. And you need a to-go bag. And I did it all. And then she called me a couple hours later behind his back, which you are absolutely not supposed to do as a couples counselor, and said, I am worried for your safety. This is not going to get any better. I'm telling you right now, you need to get out of this marriage. Mm. And I was like, whoa. And that was my rock bottom, I think.
Yeah.
You know? And by the way, it still took me another month.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, plans don't come by easy when you have to take children out of a home and move. Yeah, it's hard.
Well, I think it's also, and again, I mean, all the articles and research I've read about cults and just interviews, I mean, because I read a lot of survivor stories and ex-member stories, because I think that's how, as a therapist, I can learn more, because I would love to be able to work with that population. Because I think anybody can be brought into a situation like that. And what I see like more and more is that, you know, they just... It's the re-entry and the admitting things that have happened and getting out of that gaslighting and just hearing people's personal stories, because it's so easy, I think, as people to be like, that could never happen to me. Right. Then you hear the story and you're like, oh, this man had a traumatic childhood and then was in an abusive relationship. And, you know, then the lady left him and, oh, this guru is like, oh, come into I have a group that will help you. And we're all like-minded. And, you know, you're that vulnerable. And a lot of people, you know, are suicidal and they walk into it. It's like, you know, it literally could happen to anyone. Yeah. And until but I think leaving it is so, it's like, everyone's like, it's easier said than done. I mean, you don't know any different. Mm-mm.
And then, you know, a lot, and for us being the submissive wife in our culture, it's you can't do it on your own without a man. And so stepping out as a single parent and being, okay, I'm going to provide for these kids. And I've been out of the workforce. I had been out of the workforce for like 10, 15 years at the time. You know, it's like, I'm going to have to support children with a shoddy work history right now with nothing. Like my vehicle was the only thing I had. And well, a moving truck full of stuff that I moved when he was at work. But other than that, I had nothing, you know, like I had to take out a credit card before I left so I could use his income to have enough balance to be able to order the moving truck because I had no money of my own. And yeah, it took me a month or two to plan my escape.
Yeah. Yeah. And people don't realize, may I ask, how were you brought into your situation?
So I was actually, I was a very rebellious teenager.
Shocking.
Golfing.
We spent the hour with you, but no, you know, it's fine.
So, and then we converted from Catholicism to Baptist when I was a teenager and I was undiagnosed ADHD. Mm-hmm. And I felt like a failure my whole life. And I felt like I would never get my parents' approval. I moved out when I was 17, decided to join the Air Force. They signed off on it. My dad was also in the Air Force when he was younger. And then, so he was all happy about that. Mm-hmm. And then I needed to move back home before I went to boot camp. And so the requirement was that I went to the Basic Life Principles seminar with Bill Gothard. I mean, he wasn't physically there, but they had, you know, all around the country. It was his teachings. And it was a week long or a 4-day long thing, like 21 hours of teaching. Wow. So it's like drinking, like she's described like drinking out of a fire hose. Like you. Wow. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
It hooked people into the It's like the first step was to go to this.
And so I remember sitting on the grounds, having lunch on one of the all day sessions. And I'm like, well, maybe this is why my life has been so chaotic. Not the fact that I had ADHD that was untreated, but that I can't do anything right because I'm probably not living by God's standards. And so if this man has the recipe and the checklist, because checklists are amazing when you have ADHD because you can follow them. So it was like, well, maybe this is why I struggle so much. And if I did this, maybe I wouldn't struggle so much. And so I jumped in and my parents were thrilled. So I finally had that acceptance that I had been so longing for. And we came home and we grabbed all of my Pearl Jam and Metallica and Tool and Candlebox and every 90s band that I loved, CDs that I had painstakingly went to Blockbuster to get every week.
Blockbuster. Aww.
Put them in a pile and burned them.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yes.
Wow. So,
and that's how I got
in. Was that like required? Like, were you told to do that?
I wonder if that was in the basic at some point.
But don't remember if it was in the basic.
It was rock music was evil. So
I think it was. And it was strongly encouraged to burn or get rid of that. They did teach that if you had anything like that in your home, that you could bring evil spirits into the home and mm-hmm. be attacked. And so you were encouraged to burn it because that would like cleanse the spirit from your home. So that's probably where she got that.
I mean, not like it couldn't go into the smoke and like seep into the, you know.
Well, but the reasoning behind it obviously is to get rid of who you are, your individuality, and that's part of it is
a cleansing. You know, it was supposed to be a cleansing or whatever, and you know, getting rid of the old
break
stuff.
Break all ties with the world is mm-hmm. kind of
right. Well, but if you feel the world has betrayed you, and someone's telling you this is how you break all ties and cleanse yourself and come forward, and you're in a state where you feel like you've never been accepted. And you're, you know, and again, like you're fighting any kind of mental health thing. And then all of a sudden you're being embraced into a situation and they're like, and all you have to do is give up, you know, these outside things.
It's worth it.
Yeah, it's worth it. And it probably even doesn't feel like a lot, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. again, I can only relate it to, you know, DV stuff, but it's like, you know, so much of who I am, I'd like given up. And I just remembered at some point being like, I just want to be who I was when I was 16.
Yes.
Like, it's all I want. You know,
you want to be me. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, where did that person go? I'm not doing any of the things I thought I was going to do, all because, you know, he's comes first. And this is what, you know, I have to do what he says mm-hmm. and without ever realizing that was like even really happening to me, yeah. You know, and I remember a girlfriend once saying to me, like, you know, this isn't who I thought you would be. This isn't where I thought you would be in life. Like, and she'd known me since I was 15. And she was like, isn't what I thought. And it resonated so hard because I just remember thinking, me either.
So in the Jewish religion, I'm guessing that it's very patriarchal as well. Do you think that is why you fell into that role?
I don't know, because me and my younger sister really bucked the, you know, Judaism. I rarely have dated anyone that's Jewish. And I went to a Jewish camp and my grandmother was vice president of Hadassah. And, you know, I have a friend who calls our camp Jewish Zionist Socialist Sex Camp.
I remember you saying that on one of the episodes.
Yeah, when I like offended the crap out of Jody, which is hard to do. I was like, oh, I can't believe I offended her. Like, she was like mortified. It was really fun. It's like probably the first time I've ever done that. And I still think it's funny, but yeah, because they like wanted us obviously to like procreate and I didn't fall into that. I think he reminded me of my parents, both my, you know, my mom and my dad, but probably more my mom. But, and it was, you know, it's that, and again, it's that like, oh, I know you, you know, like we're meant to be, cause I know you. It's like, no, it's like, it wasn't a good no. Like it just, felt familiar. And I was also really young. I was in college when I met him. I got married when I was 27, you know, which I look back now and I'm like, God, like that's really young. And my mom got married when she was 17. So like, you know.
Yeah. I was 23 when I got married. I had spent 3 months in headquarters up at Chicago in Hinsdale, Oak Brook, Illinois, outside of Chicago. That's where we met. Uh-huh. And I came home. The church that I was attending at the time, the family that does the Christmas parties, like, hey, we're having a Christmas party and there's a guy there. I think he'd be perfect for you. And I'm like, oh, finally, maybe this is my husband.
Yeah.
And yeah, there were so many red flags that I completely ignored.
That you painted green, as Jody would say?
I painted them immaturity.
Yeah.
And that he would grow out of it.
Yes.
He was just young. We were both 23. He's like 10 days older than me, you know? And I was like, well, I finally found the guy who wants to live a Christian life and he wants to be my leader and he's going to like take care of me. And because that's the only way you get to be independent. I mean, I had been to South Korea by myself in the Air Force, but right. I w- went back home because I needed an authority. And I was like, that was the dumbest thing in the world. I should have just stayed away.
but it wasn't, because you didn't, when you know better, you do better. And I would also say this to, anyone coming out of situations like this, it wasn't dumb, and it led you to who you are now. Because people always ask me, like, oh, do you regret it? Well, first of all, no, of course not, because it's made me who I am, and I have my kids, certainly because of my marriage. But even my childhood, like, listen, that's what gave me my best friend. And, that's why Julie and I were as close as we were in 1,000 ways, trauma bonded. it is that. And how would I, would I be who I am? Would I be able to reach the people that I can? Would I do the same kind of work that I do now, and be comfortable with it? Because a lot of, there's lots of therapists this isn't their jam. And what you also need to know as a therapist, and I would say that when anyone, going back to our original, right? when anyone's looking for a therapist coming out of a domestic violence situation or getting to, if you're an ex-member and you getting out of a cult, I think that it's important to know, you shouldn't be, don't judge yourself, and don't be offended if for some reason, you like a therapist and that therapist is like, I'm not the right match for you because this is out of my realm of expertise. They're doing you a favor. You don't want someone to, if they know they're out of their element or they have biases. I mean, that is something we are taught. We got to look at, biases. And I've had to say it to clients before, that I'm like, I'm so sorry, I can't work with you. Like, I'm going to find you someone great, but I'm not the right person, because I got to be centered enough to know I have biases here, and I'm not going to be able to be a good therapist to them, and they need one, but it can't be me because I'm so strongly wedged in the opposite direction or whatever. Right.
You're not going to be able to sit your biases on the table and ignore them.
Yeah. No.
And that you need a therapist that can do that. Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. And you're going to, and it's going to happen, because there are, we're just human, And so I think when you're finding your match, that is part of it, and not to be offended, it's not personal. And like I said, the therapist is doing you a favor. They'll get you a referral. There's going to be the right person out there for you that gets you. And that's the most important thing. All the training in the world isn't going to matter if you're not meshed with your therapist, if you don't feel connected, and you don't feel safe, and you don't feel like this is the person that you can text in the middle of the night, even if they're not going to answer you, or send a message to you or whatever, then that's the wrong person for you.
If you don't feel safe, there's no healing. There's not an open door for healing if you don't feel safe. You got to feel safe with the thing. And we've said over and over again, I think that if you have to go through 15 interviews with a counselor, do it. I mean, it's hard work. It's hard to put yourself out there. It was really hard for me to get to those appointments because of small children, or just because of trauma, or because I was depressed or whatever, but keep working at it.
Keep working at it. And also, look, therapy's changed so much because of the pandemic. So much of it is virtual now.
Exactly.
Like BetterHelp comes in, and there's another one I can't remember, that connects you with virtual therapists. You can ask, you can say hey, listen, I can't get away right now. Even before the pandemic, you could do it, just people didn't think to it. I have a really crazy schedule, and I don't know if this is gonna work, or I can't meet you yet. Would it be possible for us to have a phone conversation before I even come to see you? Most therapists will give you 10 minutes. Even if it's you don't want a full session, they'll give you 10 minutes on the phone just so they can hear your story. You can see if you jive with them at all. And then if you want to book a session, you book a session.
Yeah. And ask them the important questions of, are you trauma informed?
Yes.
What is your, do you have any experience with people leaving a cult, or do you feel like you can help me in my situation? I mean, that's really a lot of the good questions, I think, for me as a survivor to ask is, number one, are you trauma informed? Have you had training?
Yeah.
But then I wanted to ask you also, just because a therapist says they have the trauma training, that doesn't necessarily mean that does it mean if they say I'm trauma informed or I have the training, are they all the same, or is there different levels? Yeah.
There's different levels. There's different certifications. Like I said, I've read so much about EMDR in the past 4 years. And because I will disclose anything, I'm actually going to start EMDR next week because I'm really curious about it, because I have PTSD anyway. And I feel that's something I think I want to get certified in, but I don't want to get certified in anything that I haven't experienced. So, cause I know that's going to be part of the certification anyway. It's like, we're going to have to do it. I'm like, sweet, I'll just do it. I'm really curious about it. And there's different kinds of trauma therapy that people are trained in. There's things with electrodes, like there's all kinds of different things, okay. You know, and a lot of people use DBT, CBT, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy. And everyone's different, you know, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, some people are going to respond to cognitive behavioral therapy. They want homework. They want a list. They want things to follow. Some people don't, like, they don't want that at all. They want more of a Rogerian technique, which is just, you know, one-on-one chatting and, you know, venting out and then finding patterns and taking them apart. And it really, you know, it depends. I would say that, again, this is a job interview. You're actually interviewing your therapist to give them a job. So ask the questions.
Yeah.
You know? Like, do you have experience working with people that have gone through trauma? Can you tell me what kind of experience you've had? Oh, you know, do you know anything about cults and ex-members? And what do you know about group therapy? Do you have resources that you'll be able to connect me to? Or if not, is that something that, you know, you're able to help me find? Because I'm curious about that. Do you do EMDR? Do you know someone who does, you know? Yeah. Is there reading that you think I could do? Do you watch documentaries on, you know, on cults? Do you know things that people have been through, even if you've never worked with somebody? Mm-hmm. I think, you know, that you just ask as many questions. You're not going to offend therapists. And by the way, if you do, definitely the wrong therapist.
Right.
Run. Right. Then they are not the right therapist for you. You know, that's good information. And look at it like a fact-finding mission, you know, like.
It's good.
That's the way that you learn to trust yourself, is to ask questions. And I think it's actually also really good practice in a safe way to learn to trust yourself.
Yeah.
Because you're asking, you're not at a grocery store. No one's going to yell at you. And again, if a therapist yells at you and they're like, that's, you know, how dare you, then hang up. Like,
not safe.
Not safe, you know?
So I have another question for you. So when I first started in therapy, I was so freshly out of the DV and I was so vulnerable and so broken that she didn't think that I was ready to go into any of the, some of those therapies. It was too much. She said, you still need to get safe. You still need to be very basic in your counseling, but we got to get you safe and feeling safe before we can move on to, like, what is it?
The EDMR,
whatever things. So what would you say to that? Like, should our listeners and people that are watching be aware that maybe they can't do that, some of that stuff right away, or they may be told to start slow and then go on to other things?
I think that building up a relationship, a therapeutic relationship with someone to start, is always a fantastic, cannot hurt. And she was probably right, by the way, to do that, like to go slow, because then you had a basis with her. So then when she referred you, it wasn't like you were going to have 500 practitioners, but you know what I mean? Like, you just needed to have a relationship with her. And I'm sure she did that. And I would have said the same thing, by the way, so that when you were ready, if she wants to refer you to do another kind of therapy, if you don't feel safe with that therapist, you can go and talk to her about it. Mm-hmm. And then she can find you a different referral.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Often, you know, they'll work in tandem where you'll sign releases with, so that, like, you know, which I will do with my person who I'm going to try with the EMDR, I'm full on signing a release that she can talk to my therapist.
Yes.
And vice versa, because that's the best way to care. And so I think that's great. But, like, listen, if you're someone who, you know, feels like, but I just want to get it all, I want to rip the Band-Aid off, like, I want to try it right away, then that's something to take up with your therapist and say, no, I've read a lot about EMDR. I feel like that's the thing for me. Like, I want to do it tandem no matter what. Is there a way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And ask the question, you know, they have to have a real good reason to say no at that point. And they might.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, so listen, you would want to know that, right? Before you just go off and do it by yourself.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, exactly. Like, if there was a good reason for me not to do it, you know, I want my therapist to say, listen, I want you to do another 2 months with me, and here's why. These are the things I'm seeing.
And she did. She's told me, this is why I don't think that we should move you forward. I don't think I was asking to move forward, but maybe I was asking where it was going, because I couldn't see a pattern. And I'm one of those people that needs patterns. And so she was saying, well, because you need to be in a safe place first. We really need to get you safe from your ex first or whatever it was. And yeah. So she explained it to me and did it very well. But so, yeah.
So, and I would say with that, a lot of people who are leaving the cult, we're helping a young lady right now who was, I think she was married really young, got divorced, and she felt so unsafe that she just left and moved states. And then she was in survival mode because she couldn't find a place to live. She was having so many triggers and she was just struggling so hard that she wound up in the mental hospital a couple of times. And it seems like the last time she was in long enough to get a really good handle on her medication. She's back home. We talked to her today. She sounds so much better. And it's because even though she's not with safest people, which is her parents, which caused all the trauma, she has a place to land and she knows she's going to be able to be safe and secure in housing. And I think that a lot of cult members could find themselves in a situation where they are only in survival mode. Yes. And it may not be the right time for you to take on therapy if you are in survival mode. I don't know anybody who could work through trying to survive and make sure you have a meal and a bed and also work on your trauma. Like, that's just too much.
It's certainly a lot. I mean, that's, again, I'd say that's where support groups probably are better, yeah. You know, at least to start, but, you know, because it's, yes, absolutely. And so, you know, be resilience is something that kicks in and you know what you can handle, yeah. And what you can't. And yeah, when you're like just trying to feed your family and get a roof over your head, you know, finding a therapist is not going to be something that is probably like top on the list. And that's fair, you know, and there's so many different shelters and support groups within, you know, shelters that help people with DV, that help, you know, cult members. And I think ex-members, I think they're not utilized as much. And I think people, again, I think it's partly because that like, that, you know, oh, you just have to be extracted and then deprogrammed, you know, and it's like, that's not how it works all the time. So, yeah. You know, I think that it gets kind of overlooked, but yeah, I agree with you. And I just think, you know, your therapist should be, you know, the safest place mm-hmm. that you can land eventually, but you do need to be ready. You need to be in a place where you're ready to do the work. And there's lots of work you can do before that, you know, sure. Getting safe, getting mm-hmm. shelter, all of that. Oh, and you brought up something that I was like, oh yes, of course. Meds.
Yeah.
Meds.
Yes.
Yes.
Like I'm not, you know, I realize, I think, you know, I think they can be overprescribed at times. I get that. I know that, you know, so much of our country specifically is on various medications, but I also know that there's reasons for it. And, you know, I've said it 1,000 times on our show and I will always say it, like, if you broke your foot, you'd get a cast. Mm-hmm. Like, don't shy away from it at all. I'm so open about the fact that I've been on medication. I'm on medication. Like, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Thank God, you know, for gabapentin, because I, jeez, my pen and Prozac, like, yep. You know, they don't need to be forever, but like, look at them as something that is helping as you are trying to reenter society and retrain your brain. That's what SSRIs specifically are designed to do. You know, they're messing with your serotonin level so that your body learns how to do it on its own again, because your fight and flight instinct is so wildly off. Mm-hmm. So not forever. And please, anyone who's listening out there, like, and I think it's so normal and so natural and so not spoken about, you are not a failure for taking medication.
It yes. is not, thank you for saying
not cheating. Mm-hmm. Like, it is mm-hmm. okay to take meds. Yeah. It is okay.
Yeah.
And I would say
forever.
And I would also say it's not against God to seek help for your health.
Yes.
And a lot of cult members have been shied away from the medical community because they just think they're all pill pushers. At 43 years old, I am finally on stimulants for my ADHD. And I was having daily panic attacks and they were prescribing SSRIs for me, which was making it worse because yeah. the problem was the ADHD. And I kept trying to tell my doctor, it's the ADHD. It dominoes into anxiety
and depression.
And depression. And then it's just this cyclical thing every day. I wake up, I can't focus, I get frustrated, I get overwhelmed, I get anxious, and then I'm depressed because I can't function. So, and it has changed my life. And I'm not meaning like drastically all of a sudden I can function better as a human, but it's to the point where I can manage. And before I was feeling like I was drowning, you know, yeah. And it's enough help for me to be able to function and support my children and earn a paycheck. Because at that point a year ago, I was like, I don't know how I can work anymore. Like mm-hmm. This is not working. Like I need help.
I think ADHD is like so under spoken about, I guess, like for lack of a better word. Like and there's been a lot of studies I've been reading about them for the last year and a half about how ADHD leads to depression and anxiety. And I really like depression because of that, exactly what you said, that cyclicalness, and that people are often put on SSRIs and it's the wrong medication and it'll send you down a spiral. But and a lot of people are diagnosed with depression and put on SSRIs, but really what they have is ADHD, but they've always thought they were depressed and maybe had ADHD, but it's the ADHD that's actually the foundation of it. And when the ADHD is treated and you start being able to function and you don't feel like a failure because you haven't been sitting in your room for 20 minutes being like, I was supposed to be doing this and I can't, because I don't even know what was I doing, and everything feels so out of control and overwhelming. And then you beat yourself up. And then, you know, get depressed, and then the anxiety kicks in because you're depressed, and then you're like, I can't be depressed. I have to get out. I got to do stuff for my kids.
And now I'm anxious because I have to do things I don't know how to do.
Exactly. And, you know, and the more that the ADHD is being treated, you know, the more that they're finding like, oh, a lot of people were misdiagnosed with depression and instead of ADHD. Although I will also say in all of the research I read about ex-members, the three things that were said was PTSD, depression, and anxiety were all.
Those are my three diagnoses.
Yeah, all right. Me too.
All three.
I'm in the club.
And I think that there may be some ADD in it or ADHD involved as well. She was just me coming this week and she was like, I really think that you probably should be assessed. I'm like, I think maybe you're right.
I'm like, there's some things where I'm like, that seems familiar.
Yeah. Oh my God. I mean, if you ever go down the ADHD assessment, although like part of me is like, do I have ADHD or am I a mom? I don't even know.
Yes.
And we talked about that today. Like, is it ADHD brain or is it mom brain?
Right.
Mom brain because it could just be just single mom brain. Like it.
Right. Like running on all cylinders all the time. I mean, my kids call me Dory or like Ariel a lot of the time because I like point at things and I'm like, what is that called? They're like a fork. I'm like, right. A fork.
Yeah.
Get that.
Yeah. The thing with the prongs, you know, you eat with. Yeah. You know,
I'm like, what is that? That did not used to happen. But like, I also, you know, I have dyslexia and I used to think that was like why I was like a really shitty student was that because I'm so dyslexic, and that's what they always told me anyway. But I found once I got to grad school, because then my nickname became Hermione because I would always sit in the front of the class and be like, but that's because I got like crazy organized all of a sudden. And I look back at that and I'm like, see, maybe same thing. I'm like, maybe I do have some ADHD and I've just learned how to mask it and cover. And because I'm so anxious, I'm so productive because my anxiety never lets me stop, yes, which is annoying.
Oh yeah. My anxiety will stop me like a ton of bricks. I don't get productive with anxiety. I just shut down. So
it's one or the other for me. I can go either way.
I'm like, I'm off and running most of the time. And I'm just now learning to really use meditation, and I've been prescribing it to almost every client I have. Like, I'm like pushing it so hard because we are taught to function at a unrealistic pace. And that if we stop, we are failing. We are lazy. We are selfish. We are, you know, but then at the same time, it's like self-care, you know, and it's like, I'm sorry. I love yoga. That is self-care to me, but it's not enough. And I feel like in this society, specifically toward women, you know, kind of, again, going back to even like, you know, just finding a man, it's like, that is just pushed on us. That self-care is when you have a man who can take care of you, and then you can lie in bed and he'll bring you breakfast in bed. But then, you know, you got to get up and do the dishes. Otherwise you're lazy and you're ungrateful. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like taking a moment, you know, what I started doing is I never take clients from a certain time in the day because I take yoga every day. It's like scheduled into my day. And without my class, I was just writing my teacher, Jenny Brill, about this today. I was like, without you, I would be a mess. Like, there's no way. I look forward to her class. I love her class. I bitched through the entire thing. It's hard. But I love it. But between, I usually have an 8 o'clock client and a 9 o'clock client. And at 10 o'clock, what I've been doing, as opposed to running around like a lunatic and trying to like fold laundry or do that, you know, I feel like I have to do things. Otherwise I'm not productive. I'm lazy. I'm selfish. I'm self-centered. The gaslighting voice in my head that I heard growing up is lie back down and put on meditation. I usually do an Oprah and Deepak. I like the 21 day series. I like make, I know it's Oprah. I can't help it. And it's all about fucking Oprah. I don't care. I just love her so much.
Whatever higher power you want.
I mean, you know, it's like I put, and it's because I was a latchkey kid also. It's like I put on Oprah and like right away, I'm like, yes.
Right. Okay. She was so calming. I loved her.
She's the most. I mean, you guys have heard me. I always make, you know, I'm always like, Jody, I'm telling the story about Oprah. I'm sure you're surprised. And she's like, shut up. Every time.
That you told the Oprah story again.
Yeah, I always do it because she hugged me and she smells like cookies. That's all. She's the best. But yeah, I mean, it's to me, like the fact that I've even gotten there, and it's funny because I say it to my clients, I've been saying it for years. If you can't find 20 minutes to meditate in your day, there's a problem. But I wasn't finding 20 minutes in my day.
I have that problem. Mm-hmm. I have the problem. And then I just added more because I have a full-time job, the podcast, and I added a part-time job. And I have teenage sons who are driving me insane and they're going to kill me. So.
You guys got to come on the Parent Lounge show with me and we can talk about that on there.
Let's do it. I love it. I would.
That's all we do. More thing. It's like, you know, we just talk about like the crazy town and how our kids are trying to, you know, slowly kill us. Mine are going to kill me by making me laugh so hard. Like the crap that has come out of their mouths. Harper said to Lulu yesterday, last night, she goes, God, I hope you hit puberty soon. And she's not even wrong. She's acting like a total mess. And Lulu just goes, why? Do you actually think that's going to change my personality? And Harper looks at her and she goes, I hope so.
So blunt and honest. I love her.
And I was like, I'm just, and I wasn't facing Lulu. I'm just trying to keep it together. Yeah. Like,
so I know we're kind of going like super crazy all over.
I know, we can wrap back up the podcast. I know. Yeah. So you're going to have to edit out like a fucking chunk of things.
God damn, it just made my job harder.
I know. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. No, I really appreciate you coming on here and I've really enjoyed our conversation.
Oh my God, same here. I'm so honored that you guys asked me. Like, seriously, it really means a lot to me. I know I make a lot of jokes on, never thought I'd say this, but you know, I'm really passionate about what I do. I love helping people. I love being of service and I just want people to feel good. And, you know, life is so short and trauma is so interwebbed in us, you know, as people. And then when you add on the kind of trauma that you guys have been through and, you know, other people have been through with leaving cults and again, with, you know, DV, I think, you know, finding your right therapist and getting the right help and being able to be out in the world and enjoying your life authentically as you and shedding that skin is, you know, a really beautiful thing. And I also want to say, I say shedding the skin and not leaving that behind on purpose because it's still a part of you. Like it's still always going to be a part of you. And I think, you know, running from that and trying to pretend that it's not is probably where people go wrong with trauma. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to meet it face to face and embrace it and figure out a way to connect both people into one.
So true. I totally agree. And one of the reasons I picked you to like reach out to was because I've seen on your podcast how you and Jody are so supportive of other creators or other women and in our experience in the world in general, it is so hard to find people who are authentic about helping women and not judging them. And I really appreciate that about both of y'all.
Oh, well, you guys are obviously our kind of moms and our kinds of people as well. I mean, I hadn't heard of you guys until you reached out to me. And it's funny because I, you know, don't always check because, like, we know I'm not great at the social media. And I did. And then I was like, oh, this is really fascinating. I hadn't thought of any kind of podcast like this. I was like, this is really interesting. And I went and listened to a couple of your episodes and I was like, this is so important. It's so important what you're doing. And people don't talk about it enough. And it's so much more common than people think.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
I mean, we have so many survivors that are just out there doing so many different things. And it's good to see that the message is getting out there. But there's so many stories and there's so many different avenues in it. And we know that, you know, our podcast is not just like a therapist. Our podcast isn't for everybody. You know, and if you can tolerate us, then, you know, stick around. If you can't, you know, find somebody that you can relate to, because they're just like the so many religions, people come out of this with so many different beliefs and they've held on to some and some people have just shed it all and they don't believe any of it anymore. And you are somewhere on somebody's spectrum. And you can relate to somebody's story. And if you don't relate to ours, we understand and no hard feelings.
And I know that you're touching people and that they feel less alone when they hear you. And that is so important. I mean, that's the biggest gift you can give, is people feel seen and feel heard in a place where they hadn't ever felt that way before. And that's, you know, that's the work, right?
Yeah,
that is the work.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad you said that, because that makes me feel like all of the hard work is for a reason. And, you know, it's our passion to reach people who are struggling and suffering so they don't have to do it alone.
Well, I'm sure that you are. And I'm looking forward to being able to recommend your show to, you know, many people I know, and certainly to other therapists as well, so that they know that you guys are out there, because we're always looking for resources to help any, you know, clients that we have with trauma. But I think even, you know, women in general, like, so much of it is our patriarchal society and, like, you know, things that are ingrained in our head. It's nice to hear strong women and single moms, you know, specifically talking about real things that they're dealing with. And, you know, in this paint everything perfect and put the highlight reel of everything on your social media, I think that's really hard to find now.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. We're real people with real problems and we're not afraid to talk about them.
Yeah.
Well, me fucking either.
I've noticed. Hey, we're with you.
You know, it's, how do you get better if you don't talk about it?
Exactly.
So we just want to thank you so much again, Celia. And please tell everybody how they can find you and your podcast.
Oh, thank you. Oh, first of all, thank you guys. Seriously, it's been such an honor and I've enjoyed it. We've spent so long talking and I could do it for like another 2 hours, but my butt's going to fall asleep. And your sister's probably going to fall asleep. So there's that. You can find me at, like we said, The Celia Behar, not because I have a big ego, but because there is another Celia Behar out there, but she's not The Celia Behar. Right. You can find the podcast at Never Thought I'd Say This on Instagram and Facebook, and I think it's Never Thought I'd on Twitter, but we don't know how to use that. So I don't know what's on there. Never Thought I'd Say This is on TikTok. See, we don't know how to use that either. I don't even know what goes up on there, but I know things do. Where else? Oh, and I've joined the Parent Lounge show. So please come and watch the Parent Lounge show. We are live at 7 o'clock Pacific time on Tuesdays, and it's rotating people and it's hilarious. It's led by Jason Cohen and Jamie Keller, and they are so funny. And then, you know, I'm on sometimes, Kate's on. We have a really good time. They have really good guests on, and we just, you know, tell ridiculous parenting stories and talk about this wild ride of crazy that we're all on.
Exactly.
Sounds amazing.
Exactly.
Pretty fun. Yeah.
I mean, if you can't have fun on the wild ride of life, then what's the point, right?
Yeah. I mean, then there is no point. So I hope everyone will come and, you know, join that as well, because I think we said it this past. Yeah, we're on a 6 month hiatus.
Oh, okay.
To do some rebranding and figure out what we want to do next, because we're also both just really busy.
That's like insanely busy. Yes.
Yeah, I haven't caught up on it. So I'm looking forward to listening to the latest episode whenever I find time to do it.
Oh, great. Well, that's the one. I spoiler alert, you know, I'm in Pacey's.
I did see that picture. I just haven't listened yet.
Yeah, I did it. You know, I do these things and then my kids later are like, Mom. And I'm like, oh, right.
Whoops, I just embarrassed my children and scarred them for life.
Sorry. Yep.
Let's call you a therapist.
people have swear jars in their house. Mine's just, you know, the future therapy jar.
I will invest in your mental health and that's what you get.
I am full on. I tell them all the time. I'm like, when you want to go, you go, and you want me to come in because you need to tell me all the things I did wrong, I'm there.
Yeah.
I'll be in the door first and being like, that is true.
Yes, I did. I'm sorry. I did it.
Yeah.
No problem. Own your mistakes. That's one, you know, that we can definitely use some learning on is owning your mistakes and not excusing them.
Yep. Absolutely. And, you know, again, it's like all of that talking about it makes it better.
Yeah, it does. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you everybody for watching this episode. We hope that you will join us on our next episode. And don't forget to come
join the rebellion.
All right. Bye, everybody.